Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now is the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, Brandon Dillon. Welcome to the UP.
Hey, thanks a lot. Glad to be back.
And I know you guys are doing a real big tour. You're visiting all over. Tell me about it.
Yeah, we started in St. Ignace on Monday morning, and we're in, boy, it's hard for me to remember everywhere we were. We've made about six or seven stops. We're in Houghton today. We'll be in Marquette tomorrow, and then we'll be going over to Newberry. And a couple other stops in between. I've got a companion, GT Long, who works for the party up here, and it's just really good. We've been talking to Democrats all over the UP, finding out what's important to them, finding out what they think we should be talking about as Democrats across the state, but particularly the issues that really matter here in the UP.
Now, are you a UP sort of guy? Do you have, you know, ever vacation up here or family from here?
Last 2 years, I've been to the UP quite a few times. Last 2 years, I've come up for the Copper Dog 150. Last year, unfortunately, as soon as I parked my car, I got a bad stomach virus. So I was in the hotel the whole time. But we'll be back this year. I believe it's on the 25th and 26th of February. And love it up here. First time I was here was in 1990. I was in a hockey tournament at Michigan Tech when I was in high school. So we love coming here. My wife absolutely loves it. So we're going to come back as much as we can. And hopefully because of all the competitive campaigns will be up here in the UP in the summer. We'll get a chance to come up here when there's not all the snow on the ground.
No, beautiful area in the summer. We definitely appreciate when, you know, ever people from downstate that are involved in the legislative scene, you're, you know, involved with the Democratic Party, that come up here to order to, you know, gauge our perspective, because it's a lot different than Lansing or Detroit. And oftentimes we'll find we're on the back end of something, because those decisions are made with the greater population in mind, and a lot of times they really just don't work up here.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think one thing is, you know, the concerns that I've heard and have heard every time I've been here, and I've talked to Representative Dianda numerous times, he makes sure that those interests of the UP get heard in Lansing. I can tell you that. I was in the state legislature and served with him before I took this position. So he's always making sure that folks know that don't forget about the 110th district, don't forget about the UP. But the concerns that people have here are very similar in general. Jobs, opportunity, public education, making sure that kids who graduate from high school don't have to move somewhere else to find work, caring for older relatives, health care. But the specifics are oftentimes different. And, you know, when you're talking about energy policy, others, there's things in the UP that we have to be aware of. And, you know, from a purely partisan perspective, we would be foolish as Democrats not to understand exactly what's on people's minds and make sure that we have our representatives and our party is speaking to those issues in a way that people feel isn't disconnected from the way that they live here, as opposed to what goes on, as you said, in Lansing and Detroit.
You touched on it briefly, and I do want to just spend at least a minute just for people that may not be familiar with you. I know this is our first time sitting down together. I know that you've slid into the chair position after Brandon Dillon announced his candidacy to go for the first congressional district here in our area. But just so our listeners know, you know, who you are and who, you know, where you came from, talk a little bit about your background.
Right, and just to make sure we're clear, it was Lon Johnson who
was the
predecessor.
What did I say?
You said me.
I said you. Following.
I'm not running for the first congressional district. I'll tell you that it's too big for me.
I know that. I just had Lon Johnson on here a few weeks ago.
So when Lon decided to step down to pursue the first congressional, you know, I saw an opportunity. I was term limited. I've been very frustrated, to be honest, about the things that have gone on in the state the last 5 years that I was in the legislature, and thought that I could have a better impact helping others who want to see some positive changes go on, try to help them get elected. So I've been there since July. It feels like I've been there much longer. This is it's a great job, but it's a lot of work. And just getting out and meeting as many people as I possibly can has been my first priority. And then making sure we have a plan that we put together to help Democrats win in 2016, obviously, is going to be the most important thing for all of us who, as Democrats going forward.
Well, we have some things to keep an eye on here for 2016. As you mentioned, of course, we have the first congressional district race for Congress. Republican Dan Benishek, who had been serving there for the previous two terms, is now retiring, not running in for that third term. And so Lon Johnson is going to be one of the ones seeking that position. There's also a few others. There is, if I'm Remember all Jason Allen from the Republican side, and then also Jerry Cannon from the Democrat side. Can you just talk about what you're looking to see happen there?
Well, first of all, I think listeners, if they don't know this already, are maybe surprised. No, this is going to be one of the most competitive congressional elections in the country. It's probably in the top five nationwide in terms of where campaign activity is going to be centered, where money is going to be spent. There's a lot of interest in this seat on both sides, Republican and Democratic parties, to try to make sure that we win it. It's one of the only, you know, pure 50-50 seats that is out there, especially in a presidential election. So there's going to be a lot of you're not going to get ignored up here. I can tell you that there'll be campaigns on both sides working hard. But Lon, I know, is out there raising a lot of money and talking to a lot of people. You still have to have enough money to compete to get your message out. He's going to post some record fundraising numbers here in the next couple of days. But I know that Senator Casperson and Jason Allen are going to have a very hard-fought primary. And it'll be interesting to see who emerges from that. But whoever does, I think our candidate is going to be well-positioned to win. And it's not going to be easy, but we're going to do everything we can to help. And, you know, it's an exciting time to be in Michigan politics, but I think it'll be even more exciting for folks up here in the UP and in the first congressional. It's going to be very, very, they will not lack for a wealth of information on both sides.
I know you don't want to give away any of your strategy coming up, but, you know, Casperson, he's a UP guy. Mm-hmm. He's been serving in our state legislature for some time now, and people are very, very familiar with him. So he's got, you know, the home field advantage.
Sure.
And one of the knocks on Lon Johnson is that he's not viewed as a Northern Michigan guy or UP guy for sure. So what are your plans on sort of approaching that argument?
Well, I will tell you first, I think it's, you know, it's probably less than 50-50 that Senator Casperson makes it to the primary. Most folks don't realize 60% of the primary vote comes below the bridge in this election. And Senator or Jason Allen, who's a former state senator and has worked in the administration here in Lansing for the last few years, has deep pockets. He has a lot of connections. His wife is a very well-respected figure in the Republican Party. So it remains to be seen who's going to come out of that primary. But I can tell you, if I was a betting man, I'd say that it's more likely that Jason Allen is the Republican nominee just because of his access to some of those resources, but also the fact that the majority of the Republican vote in the primary comes out of the Traverse City area where he's from. But be that as it may, you know, I think Lon certainly has strong roots in Northern Michigan. He's got six generations of family from Kalkaska. He ran for state rep in the 103rd district in 2012, and the same criticisms were lobbied at him, and he still performed 5 to 6 points above what an average Democrat does in that seat. So he's got a lot of energy. His values are consistent with folks' concerns here in the UP and in the broader first congressional. So I think he'll be very strongly positioned, whoever the Republican nominee is.
Now moving on to the 110th District for State Representative, Scott Dianda will be running again, going up for his third term. He would be term limited after this following term if he was reelected. We're not seeing, at least at this point, any challengers rise up, but, you know, is there anything that would give you cause or for worry that Dianda may have a challenge?
Well, I assume he'll have a challenger. You know, I was up here knocking on doors for Scott in 2012, and it was a tight race then, and we certainly don't take it for granted. But if there's anybody that embodies their constituents in the 110 districts that we have in the legislature, I think it would be Scott Dianda. He's very popular. He works extremely hard. I know I saw him the other day as he was heading back to Lansing for session. We crossed paths, and he had already made 7 stops to different areas in the district to talk to folks and check in. So we feel pretty good about Scott. But obviously, you know, that's why you work hard in the off years, is to make sure that whoever challenges you is going to have an uphill battle. And we think Scott will be in a strong position.
I've gotten to know Scott over the last few years, and, you know, from when he was running for the second time, and then, of course, you know, in these few years that he's been elected, he's what you call a youper guy.
He's a youper. There's no doubt about it. He wears his pin proudly down in Lansing. I don't know if folks have ever seen it with the state of Michigan. And the Upper Peninsula is extremely pronounced in that pin. And, you know, he when I was in caucus with him, he constantly, whenever we were talking about an issue, make sure he stood up and said, don't forget about the UP. Don't forget about the 110th District. He is he is somebody who cares about his district and his district first. Political party to him, I can tell you, I know he's a good Democrat, but if it's not good for his district, he's not going to vote for it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because that's kind of how I, you know, I've gotten to view him is, yeah, his, you know, his beliefs as somebody from this area, you know, that's what he runs on. And mm-hmm. rather than, you know, say towing the party line, it's what he feels is right, whether it's guns, it's environment, mm-hmm. it's business up here. You know, you hear that from him. And that's not trying to sound like an endorsement of Scott Dayan, other than to say I've gotten to know him and he's a good friend, I would think.
Well, and I think it's borne out if you look at some of the rankings of legislators. You know, they do these, you know, most conservative, most liberal. Scott is usually right in the middle there, and it reflects, I think, well upon his district, because folks in the 110th district are you know, they have concerns that transcend party ideology. Some folks are, you know, more conservative on some issues, more progressive on others. And I think Scott does a great job of really being a true representative by balancing all those concerns and voting what he knows the constituents in his district want. And that's what you should get out of any representative, no matter what party they're from. They should be voting their district first.
Sure. Well, we're going to cast the net a little wider and talk about some statewide issues. And this is, you know, a first opportunity that I've had for somebody from downstate to come up and be able to ask some of these questions. We'll get plenty of news up here. We have our news service, and it all comes sort of already filtered. And whether they're audio cuts or somebody else that wrote stories. So, for instance, in like Flint, where the water crisis has been going on here now for some time, we're not there.
Right.
So we're getting, I hate to call it secondhand news,
sure,
but I'd love to be able to hear, you know, your take on how the situation is standing right now and certainly how it affects in the Lansing legislature.
Yeah. Well, it's a terrible human tragedy. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The inability to be able to drink water out of the tap or bathe your children in water without fear of either getting lead poisoning or some sort of, you know, dangerous rash is very, very disturbing. It's not something that should happen anywhere in the United States, but certainly in the Great Lakes state where we're surrounded by fresh water. It really does damage, again, to the image of pure Michigan as well, which will have impacts not just in Flint, but across the state. You know, the concern that we've expressed, and we've expressed this going way back before the national media and others really understood the gravity of this issue, is that we have to have accountability, not just to know for this governor what he knew when he knew it and why they didn't react with the urgency that one would expect when folks are coming to city council meetings and other meetings with jugs of dirty brown and yellow water, but, you know, why the decision was made to switch to the Flint River, who ultimately made those decisions, so that it doesn't happen again. And I think that's the biggest concern we have. Michigan has some of the worst, if not the worst, transparency laws on the books. We've been ranked dead last in terms of ethics and open government by two good government organizations, nonpartisan groups, expanding the Freedom of Information Act so that we can actually get access to the records of the governor and the legislature, much like every local official here, whether they're in Houghton or anywhere in the UP, is subject to that same scrutiny. That's going to be important. But right now, the focus should be on making sure that that community gets the help it deserves. Unfortunately, it's going to cost a lot of money to fix this problem. Even the governor himself said that the costs are incalculable at this point, and we should all be concerned about that.
Down the list of things that I wanted to talk about, and we may not get to it, and it's fine, but the big story of the fall of 2015 was where the $700 million for roads or right. whatever that money, I can't remember the exact amount, where that money was going to come from. That might be dwarfed by what this Flint water crisis is going to end up costing the state once you add in all the lawsuits and everything else involved.
Yeah, it was a concern at the time.
You don't hear much about it now.
Well, you don't.
The roads.
I mean, I think the reason that road package was in many ways not a good package, but irresponsible to rely on, you know, a kind of mythical $600 million that we're somehow going to cut out of the budget. And at that point, people were not focused on Flint. They were focused on the impact of public education or what happens if we have an economic downturn, making sure that we can fund community health care and police and fire service. And, you know, the roads package, you know, was bad for many, many reasons, but, you know, taxing middle-class folks and working-class people and letting heavy trucks and big corporations off the hook, that's bad in itself. But now where we have these looming fiscal crises and public health crisis in Flint, you know, it's hard to imagine that that money is going to be there in a way that the folks who voted for this package thought it would be or hoped it would be. I think this is going to be a very expensive proposition in Flint. It also opens up a lot of other issues about the aging infrastructure that we have under the ground with lead pipes and others in many of our older communities. People are going to have to start looking at what we're going to do to replace those systems, and those are not an inexpensive proposition.
We have pockets up here in the UP where the water is not good. Mm-hmm. We even have high lead levels of lead. The amount of concern that's being played into Flint, why is it different than, say, the natural occurrences of bad water that we have in rural areas?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's just as important that we're also, I mean, I think if there's any silver lining to this tragedy, and I'd hate to even use that phrase, but that it has drawn attention to the issue of clean, safe drinking water, not just in Michigan, but across the country. There's communities in Ohio that are talking about decisions that were made that might have imperiled the water supply. There's national research that's been going on since this that suggests folks are now more concerned than ever about making sure that their water is clean. But I think what happened in Flint really drove home the point because it didn't have to happen. It was essentially a man-made disaster, and not just the initial switch to draw water from the Flint River, which I think many folks are going to second guess for a long time period to come. But even after they did, you know, they didn't use the proper chemicals to treat the water. They ignored the advice of outside experts about the corrosive quality of the water in Flint. So I think that it's getting a lot of attention because I think it's very attributable to actual decisions that have been made in the present time that caused that crisis to occur. But it does not diminish from the fact that other communities in the state where people are being exposed to water with high lead content or other toxins should be a cause for concern as well.
I believe that we were one of the first local news agencies to begin running regular stories about the Flint water crisis, and we picked it up probably in the fall when it started to hit mm-hmm. more on the state level. And at the time, and even really sometimes now, I'll be asked, why does it matter to the people here up in the UP? I mean, there's a great amount of distance. We've got a nice big bridge in between us. You know, why are we concerned about what's happening in Flint so much that it's on our daily news? And my response to that is, regardless of the water situation, which we should be concerned first from a humanitarian standpoint, the situation may end up costing the state's governor. Mm-hmm. You know, and that does affect us because we're all under the state legislature. And of course, now it's a hard argument to make against because it's a national, even world news type story.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, apart from just the basic human misery that you're seeing in Flint, which I think all people, no matter who they are or where they live, have a concern for. You don't want to see your neighbors, people that live in your state, have to go through something that they shouldn't have to go through. But apart from that, I think what people should be most concerned about is the fact that we had a system of government that allowed this to happen. And it shouldn't be lost on people that democracy in Flint was essentially taken away by the appointment of an emergency manager. And we have struggling communities all over Michigan. And one of the arguments that I've made for a long time and others have made is that, you know, it's easy to make to just cut the budget to be able to get yourself a balanced budget. But if you're not accountable to the people that you serve and you make decisions without understanding the overall impact of public health and public safety, it can have very serious consequences. And we're seeing it there. So I think folks around the state should be very concerned about the loss of local control that happened in Flint, but also the lack of accountability and transparency that there is in state government right now with this exemption from the Freedom of Information Act that the legislature and governor have. We may not see a crisis like this, and God forbid it happens anywhere else in the state, but there are other important issues that if we're not aware of the decisions that are being made on our behalf, it's hard to hold people accountable, and that erodes trust in the system and makes it more difficult for people to have a strong quality of life.
Where do you see this ending up?
Well, I don't know. I think there's a lot of this story that still remains to be seen. I mean, we've called on the governor to not only release his emails from 2014, but also 2012 and 13, where those original decisions and warnings about the the hazardous nature of drawing water from the Flint River were made. We also believe that we need to see all the correspondence from the governor's staff and between them and the emergency manager. So I don't know where it ends up. I think it's very safe to assume this is going to cost the state a lot of money. There's civil lawsuits. The governor was subpoenaed yesterday as part of a class action lawsuit. Other organizations have sued the state to demand that the pipes in Flint are replaced immediately. There's going to be ongoing health costs associated with children with high lead levels, whether that's increased costs to our criminal justice system or a special education system, or making sure that kids have proper nutrition to help mitigate the effects. I don't know where the scandal will end up, but I know the overall effects of this crisis are going to, Michigan is going to see that for a long, long time. And it won't just be folks in Flint. It'll be taxpayers across the state from the Keweenaw Peninsula all the way to downriver Detroit.
Right. Now I'm going to reel it back home a little bit, because we could probably talk about this for a long time, but I'm sure I know I could.
Yeah.
You know, but let's talk about something that is directly important to us here, and that's the energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been times where we've looked at facing skyrocketing energy prices. There's other times where people have come with some great ideas that will help us, yet we don't see a whole lot of fruition. If you were kind of, you're touring the whole UP, what are you seeing as, you know, both the problems and the solutions?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, I'm certainly not a policy expert on energy policy, but I do think there's been a lot of concerns expressed across the board, not just Democrats, but Republican representatives in the Upper Peninsula about making sure that we have, you know, the propane crisis that had the propane shortage and crisis a couple years ago, I think drew into sharp focus the difference in energy security that you have in the UP as opposed to folks downstate who kind of take those sources for granted. But whatever energy policy the legislature comes up with, I think it is critically important to make sure that it is fair and balanced, and make sure that folks in the UP can afford the skyrocketing costs of energy, but also just as important to make sure that that supply of energy is consistent and reliable, so that you know, folks can get to work, folks can have heat in their homes. But, you know, I trust Representative Dianda to be able to carry that message. And, you know, I tried, now that I've stepped away from the policy arena, I try not to I try not to get too involved, because I might say something I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, that's all right. I do it all the time.
Yeah, listen, you know, but you're here, so you know the concerns. I one of the areas I focused on in the legislature was education policy and funding for education. So I still have a strong interest and knowledge base of that. Energy policy, I believe Representative Dianda is on the Energy and Tech Committee, so he's going to have a strong voice in that. And I'd encourage folks to keep communicating with him as these decisions are being made, because I know he has the interest of the UP at heart.
All right. Well, then let me throw something your way that would be up your alley. Another story that I've been asked, why do I run up here? And that is Detroit Public Schools debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to understand, get people to understand that their debt may be our debt.
That's right.
We've got great school systems here that are well-funded. Well, you know, I think they're well-funded. My daughter goes to one, and they've got a great school.
Right.
And I worry about that amount of money that the governor is talking about pulling from everybody else to fund one school system. Mm-hmm. And again, it's far away from us, but it could end up costing us money too.
Well, you're absolutely right. What's going on in the Detroit public school system is extremely troubling. The financial problems they've had for a long time have not gotten any better. And, you know, I'm quick to remind folks that the same emergency manager that made the decision in Flint to switch to the Flint River is now the emergency manager in Detroit Public Schools. Now, all the blame doesn't go to him. These are problems that have been going on for a long time. But certainly the financial liabilities at DPS have gotten worse in the last 5 years, not better. And ultimately, a failing school system, much like when the city of Detroit went through bankruptcy, you know, folks had varying views on what we should do with that. But there are liabilities that will be incurred if Detroit Public Schools cannot pay its liabilities. The state is on the hook for that. And there's only two sources of revenue you can go to get that. You can either take it from the school aid fund, which is a finite group of amount of money that comes from every school district in the state, or you can take it from the general fund, which also impacts services and funding for local communities. So getting a handle on this is critically important. I know that this is a real bipartisan effort. The governor, to his credit, has engaged in this. But so far, I don't think there's buy-in from the Republican legislature about the crisis yet. And, you know, I hope that this can be resolved in a way that minimizes significantly the burden on school districts across the state and actually doesn't impact them at all, which will require some hard choices as far as, you know, what we're going to do with those school systems in Detroit and charter schools that are sucking money out of the system, which makes it harder to run. So I think there's some good ideas on the table. It's got to get solved, but you're right to be concerned about that, even up here in Houghton, because, you know, as taxpayers in the state of Michigan, we're all liable for the failures or successes of school districts everywhere.
Brandon Dillon, I want to thank you for coming up here to Houghton. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure.
A lot of things we could talk about, so I hope you come back
again. I will soon. Be back. And anytime, I'd love to come back and talk with you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.